Hey now, welcome to the City Off Campus podcast with your two favorite hosts, Sammy Sommerfeld and Jack McFarland. Today we're with Doug Kazarian, who's the host of Daily Wager and at ESPN and also does quite a few other shows, including we're recording on Friday. He just came from SportsCenter. So my first question for you, Doug, thanks for coming on, is what's it like being a part of ESPN where you get to be a part of so many different programmings and be a part of different shows? Like, what's that process like? What's the scheduling like? How does that all work?
You know, it's a very applicable question because there are so many people behind the scenes that make it all work. And thanks for having me on. Good to be with you guys. Look, SportsCenter is awesome. It's, you know, I grew up watching it, you know, just like a lot of us out there, and to be able to do any sort of hosting or whatever, it's a total dream come true. But then after a while, that kind of new car smell wears off and you just got to get down to business. And having worked at ESPN for 8 years now, on my ninth, and, you know, I've been on the other side hosting, anchoring SportsCenter the conventional way. So being a guest for like a minute and a half, it's great. And I know the producers I'm working with. So basically, you know, you guys do it yourself. You put together a rundown. What are we going to talk about? For you guys this week, it's a layup, right? You got to lead with Iowa State. Top 10 matchup, first time in the Cy-Hawk rivalry history. Sometimes it's not that obvious. So they have some stuff probably in their show. They're going to like lead with Dallas and Tampa Bay recap. Maybe they'll have an analyst on. So they're putting together the giant puzzle that is the one-hour program. But they know when Fridays they want to look ahead to college football. Now, as a SportsCenter producer, so I do some betting-specific content. So all of our show is betting-driven, right? But if you do it more of a wide-ranging sports show, how much of it is going to be betting? How much of it is inclusive to the non-bettors, but also inclusive to the bettors? And you kind of find that sweet spot, that appetite. So they've put together the rundown. So they decided at some point they want about a minute and a half, 2 minutes of betting picks for the college football weekend. Just college football is such a big betting thing for sports viewers on the weekends. We're not, you know, I've done WNBA picks. I like the W, but that's like the other end of the spectrum, or baseball or whatever. So, we schedule, hey, are you available this time on Friday? Yes, I am. Okay. A segment producer is going to reach out. And so I go back and forth with the segment producer. Last week, they wanted to do the four big games, like the marquee games, all on national television. So started with the Alabama-Miami game. Then at night, it was Georgia-Clemson. Then Sunday, Notre Dame-Florida State. And then Monday, Ole Miss with Louisville. So that was easy. We did those four games. This week, they're like, just give us your best bet. So depending on the weekend, it'll dictate. So tomorrow morning, I'm doing three college picks for radio and then one NFL, looking ahead to the opening week in the NFL. So it just kind of depends. Then I communicate. I give them my four best plays. And so last week, they were the big games, right? Some marquee blue blood schools. This week, we're on South Alabama. We're on Temple. You know, just schools like that. But, you know, we had a good chuckle about it.
That's awesome. And so you quickly, right when we got started, you said, you know, your former stomping grounds in Iowa. I know Iowa and Missouri were two of the states you kind of started your journey and working in sports media. Where in Iowa did you start, and what was your experience covering Iowa sports?
So I was, I worked in the Quad Cities, and so not too far away from Iowa City. And I was there that year they went to the Orange Bowl and lost to USC, the Brad Banks year. I think they just lost to Iowa State that year and then ran the table. I think it was Seneca Wallace was with the Cyclones that year. So later in the season, I was going to every media day. I didn't travel or anything like that. They were about an hour away from, but they were still, we had Iowa fans in our market. It was sort of split Iowa, Illinois, kind of like it was split Cubs and Cardinals. But I enjoyed it. No, look, I'm from L.A. Kind of, you know, they talk about the old adage of growing up in a small town and moving to the big city. I did it the reverse way. I grew up in a big city, moved to the small town. So going to Missouri for only a few months, and that was the college town, Columbia, Missouri, where the Tigers are. So I was covering Big 12 sport. It was a very progressive situation in the university. All university towns are just different, right? So I really got my sort of small town vibe, and it's not that small. It's not like a total, you know, drive your tractor to school day, like some places that I actually did coverage in Missouri on. But Quad Cities was awesome. I was there 4 years. Did sports, but I did also was a main news anchor for a little bit. And then being about 2.5 hours or so to Chicago door to door was good to sort of scratch that big city itch whenever I needed it. Friends from college were there. And, but I loved it. I loved the local scene. I went back a few times after I had moved to Vegas. So this was, and we're talking 20 years ago when I first moved to Iowa a little after 9/11, November of 01. So I loved it. I look back at it fondly, and those are formative years. Obviously, you guys will experience it, but my early 20s, you sort of figure yourself out in a lot of ways. Not that any of us have figured it out, but you learn a lot. So there's a maturation process. You're learning a ton about the business. That was my first real job. Like I said, I mentioned Missouri. I was only there a few months. It was my first true job in local television. And obviously, I can't be more appreciative of the opportunities I was given.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to ask you was, so kind of jumping from early in your career to the start of your career at ESPN, how did that opportunity come about? And how did you put yourself in a situation to get to ESPN? And going into the college thing, I wanted to ask you a few things about the college game day, but we'll kind of start.
I can only speak to my way of doing things, which is sort of the old school way. It's still fairly common, but the best analogy is kind of like minor leagues of baseball, right? And I don't want to be, you know, mocking of anything, but it's dictated by market size. So New York is one, LA two, market size being the viewers that you access. And, you know, that's what it is in the TV world. So 255 or whatever Anchorage, Alaska is that the other end of the spectrum. So being able to cut my teeth, so to speak, in Iowa in a nice size market 92, I believe it was when I worked there, and have some bells and whistles and have some good stable sort of facilities and things like that was great. I mean, a lot of friends I have now started back in the day in market 150 or so. And so I'm there for 4 years. You send out demo reels to prospective employers, and there's websites that have job postings, and there's headhunters, and sort of have to figure it out yourself. And then I found a job in Las Vegas, got the job. I flew out and interviewed, and it was funny. I was flying out around Halloween, and everyone's going to Vegas to rage. My Southwest flight is nuts. They're like hanging, you know, they're playing like the toilet paper pass game. I'm sitting there in a button down khakis, like, am I really moving to Vegas if I get this job? And I had grown up in Los Angeles, like I mentioned, and loved Vegas and was very familiar with it. But the interview was great. The station was awesome. And so I got the job and moved there. And I stayed there for 7 years. And that was through the 2008-09 financial crisis. Obviously, local TV had kind of taken a hit starting then. And it was just a different animal. And websites became a thing. And now the websites were always there, but it was always an afterthought for local television or any media company. Now it was like a driving revenue generator. And there were opportunities to do cross promotion. And then I started doing some radio when I was in Las Vegas. So I'd always been into sports betting. I grew up with four older brothers. And it was sort of part of my, I don't want to say DNA, but always something that intrigued me. And then my local kind of television path just coincidentally took me through Las Vegas. And then that's when I sort of dove in, right? I realized there are no pro teams here at the time. So no Golden Knights, no Raiders. But that was the pro team, in addition to boxing, big events, or UFC. So I covered it, and then I did a bunch for my local show. I was giving out picks, did bad beats of the show, and all this crazy stuff you can get away with when it was legal, because it was legal in Nevada. And then I started a radio show with a couple of good friends from the Las Vegas Review Journal, which is the local newspaper, and we did a betting show at midnight. So after we all got off work and did their regular jobs, we went and did that for an hour, did a podcast, website, all that. And then it was picked up by the local ESPN radio affiliate. And so it was a drive time radio show that was all betting driven leading into the first pitch or kickoff or whatnot. So it was betting very established in like betting circles. But again, we're talking 2011, 12-ish. And then at the time, I had since gotten an agent, which is very helpful for the job placement difficulties of the career. Because I mentioned earlier, there's website stuff. That's more for sort of the medium markets and lower. When you're talking the higher level, they have talent offices at these networks, and they're in constant communication with the agents who are really good at their job, but there is a portion that's a headhunter job, and that's one part of their job. So I one thing I did as I was at Vegas for like 5-6 years, my agent and I would say, hey, let's try to have some open dialogues with a lot of networks or even top, you know, 20 markets or so. So anytime I flew to a city with like networks or whatever for a wedding or work or whatever, I'd give my agent a heads up. He'd schedule some informal meetings. So I was going to New York for a wedding, told my agent, and then he was able, like, hey, Friday morning, can you drive to Bristol and meet with these two people at 9 a.m. and 9:30? I'm like, absolutely. So I actually rented a car on my own, drove to Bristol Thursday night, because I flew in like Wednesday for the wedding weekend. And that morning. I met, and it was a little nostalgic. I had gone to school in the Northeast, so driving back with all the foliage, and actually that was in the spring, but just still, like, there was some, like, it just took me back to when I started my career and met with the right people. It went well, came back for a formal interview, and then you do the audition and all that, and I was able to get the job. So it was basically, you know, you try to, they say it in sports, you got to create your own luck. So I helped create my own luck, but then obviously it was timing and opportunity, sure.
So you've been covering sports betting for, let's say, 15, nearly 20 years. Mm-hmm. What keeps it interesting to you, or what do you look forward to every time you wake up and you look at the slate of lines, or like, what do you look forward to every day with sports betting? Like what gets you going?
Yeah, I think it's like the, I don't want to say bragging rights, but it's just like the challenge of sort of figuring out situations, right? And I'm very sort of game specific driven. Like, I like the backstories, don't get me wrong, and especially the human interest natures of sports, the business side of sports. I like it all. I was obviously passionate about conventional sports anchoring. That's what I did when I was back, when I went to ESPN initially hosting SportsCenter. But the, you know, the training I got on air was obviously helpful, and you kind of, it's competitive advantage. Like, I was established in the betting space, to your point, I've been covering it for so long. And then I had all this incredible training with ESPN and then previous television stops that it was a no brainer. So I like being an analyst, and I like analyzing games and talking about who's going to win, who's going to lose, because ultimately that's what matters. And I also love the craft of anchoring, and it's just a really cool thing that I've always loved. I'm sure there's personality profiles people can do in terms of what stimulation and the ADD component. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff, angles you can take, but I just love A, sports, B, discussing who's going to win. And then like that layer of like the point spread, which is essentially the margin of victory, makes things interesting. So like the math component, I was an econ major, so the math of it all, the numbers of it all. But in general, I think it's just the camaraderie and being able to get a little bragging rights too. It's kind of fun to talk kind of nuanced within the deep layers of sports.
And it's interesting, you've started covering it when, I wouldn't say betting was taboo, but it wasn't as widely legalized as it is now. And how have you seen, if any, change in how sports betting and all of that is talked about and covered and shared amongst peers? Has it just kind of stayed constant and now it's just more on a mainstream level?
No, Jack, it's a great point, because it was taboo. That is the right word. It was certainly frowned upon. I mean, you couldn't even have Vegas commercials during the Super Bowl. The NFL wouldn't allow it. And Vegas was always kind of fighting for that acceptance. Now, I would be critical of Vegas in a tasteful way, of course, but I would say you can't have it both ways. You can't have marketing campaigns and all these commercials that say what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and have billboards of strip clubs and all this other stuff, and then get offended when people don't take you seriously as a regular city. You have to pick kind of a path and own it. And so it was difficult to put the toothpaste back in the tube, so to speak, and try to get that nationwide acceptance. It's not like that people were saying Vegas shouldn't exist, but when you're branded with the Las Vegas Strip, and I know it's only 5 miles in a city that has nearly 2 million population, you can't have it both ways to the masses, obviously the people. So when I moved here, friends would visit and it'd be all about the Strip, but like I golfed, I ran a marathon back within a couple of years of moving here, and I trained up in Red Rock. Red Rock to my door is right now 12 minutes. And it's altitude and it's beautiful and you don't think you're in Vegas at all. And so of course there's a lot about the city, but it was the nature of the beast. You have a marketing campaign that's all about debauchery and other everything else. You can't proclaim to be this normal city because you're not. So embrace the lack of normalcy. And that's what former Mayor Oscar Goodman did. Anytime he had an event with the NBA or anywhere, he brought two showgirls. And it was about the pizzazz and spice of Las Vegas. Now, it wasn't inappropriate. It wasn't tasteless. It was about having fun. Vegas is special. There's a sparkle to the city. And so the NHL eventually came around and realized that they needed Vegas more than Vegas needed the NHL. And then once it was a home run with the Golden Knights, now it helped go into the Stanley Cup in the inaugural season, but that there weren't betting scandals and there wasn't all this craziness. And yes, there was that little Vegas flu narrative and some teams would party too hard, but you know, Tortorella and some of the other guys were pushing it. They're like, we saved our rookie hazing. It's usually the first road trip, but we saved it for Vegas because it builds chemistry. So coaches were all in on blowing a game here and there, starting third string goalie, see what happens. But in general, that was a big step to get a professional sports team here. And just to see a commissioner of a sports league on the dais next to a gaming operator, CEO, or whatever it was. And that started it. Mark Davis was obviously huge bringing it to Vegas. But to your point, the taboo component to it all, the erosion of the stigma started with the Supreme Court ruling in May of 2018. That's really what started. And then I don't blame those who kind of viewed gambling a certain way, because in a lot of ways, it's the betting market, it's like the stock market, but in other ways, it is a vice. So if you're a purist and you view the same gambling, like, the thing that like Scott Van Pelt would always say is allow people to be adults. You can't allow betting, you can't allow alcohol, you can't allow lotteries in every state, and then all of a sudden ban it. Now, with that being said, if you're a major corporation or a major sports league and something is against federal law, you cannot be in bed with it, so to speak. So once the federal ban was lifted in 2018, so even before states got were permitted to pursue this on a state-by-state basis, the tone changed. The federal Supreme Court said it's ridiculous that this was banned. So I think that's sort of the beginning of the erosion, but absolutely there was a stigma to it all.
And did you ever in your wildest dreams, when you lived in Vegas and you had that midnight hour, you guys would go on the podcast, did you ever expect to be at this day where you're on ESPN, you're talking about betting like this?
No.
Widely? Never.
No, it's funny. I had a good buddy who's a pro bettor in town, and we were good friends then too. And we were like, at a bar or whatever, and he saw like them like flash like a futures thing or something that was a very casual, very newsy element. He's like, man, you should be on ESPN talking about sports. I was like, well, you're an idiot. Like, it's like people outside the broadcasting industry have no idea. I'm like, you don't know what it's like, dismissive. When we launched the radio show, my buddy was very, passionate and adamant that eventually in due time, this will become more mainstream. And he goes, you really want to do a sports radio show where it's just like you're yelling about, some stupid thing, whether Tony Romo should start when he comes back from injury or whatever the topic was. Or do you want to be different and talk about betting because it is the biggest thing in the world that no one talks about and you're good at it? It's like we have a competitive advantage being in Vegas and we have the relationships and the networking. So I give they were much more bullish than I was. I was still in that like corporate mode where it was almost like a dual life I was living, where I had this passion, especially at ESPN. I mean, people knew I came from Vegas, but I was trying to be, the next Steve Levy or whatever, instead of just like the first Doug or whatever. So I'm very grateful that ESPN played the long game with me, understood that I had sort of some value in this area, and they kind of anticipated that they might need me if the Supreme Court ruling went their way or went our way. So I'm a lot of things. It was a lot of support and a lot of people in my corner that kind of opened it. But yeah, to answer your question, no. I mean, I thought in a pipe dream that would be the case, but I never thought it was actually possible.
How did that transition go about too, from you being, a guest co-host on Mike and Mike and on all these radio programs, doing, the radio for ESPN College Game Day, for SportsCenter, NBA Tonight, all these different Outside the Lines, all these different shows, to then you become the ESPN bets guy? Like, you become Daily Wager, they create that, you move to Vegas. Like, how did that opportunity, and when was the moment for ESPN, like, let's innovate into the gambling stuff? Like, what was the moment for them? And then when did they kind of bring you into it? How did that kind of all come into a fold?
No, it's a good question. And when we launched Daily Wager, it was a big thing saying, hey, we've been in this betting space for a while. This is just the latest step. Mm-hmm. And to your point, the whole just host nature has changed in the broadcasting world the last 5 years or 6 years. You have Van Pelt treating it more opinion and then also hosting, because prior to that, it's about anchors and hosts ask the question, experts answer them. We have changed that a little bit. And I mean, obviously now I get to play both host and analyst. And so basically it's like Teddy Bruschi can ask, Ryan Clark what his experience was like in the Super Bowl. And it's not like Bruschi doesn't have his own opinions, having won a couple of rings. But you can have two guys who have different experiences from the same. He's just as credible, but just because he's asking the question doesn't mean he's less credible. And that's sort of the approach we went. But going back, when I was hosting things and traffic copying and doing that, my opinion mattered less. And that was okay. That was the nature of television at the time. I mean, since then, CNN, Fox, they have hosts who have opinions and drive it. Opinions not just for radio anymore, right? There's a middle ground. Radio is more extreme with opinions. TV has a little bit. So it's kind of in between the columnist and the reporter and the straight news reporter. So what happened is I was doing the conventional SportsCenter anchoring and radio and all that. But ESPN.com's chalk section, which is the betting section, had already been launched. And they had a little bit of content, not like it does now. And we started to have some conversations. And we said, hey, there's a place for this. Maybe during football season, we could do a minute SportsCenter hit. You're the guy. Like, so I basically did double duty for about a year, where I was doing the regular SportsCenter stuff at night, and then I'd go do like a minute hit on a Monday to recap the weekend, or Friday to look into the weekend. And then I would start to write content for ESPN.com, and it started with the newsers, we call them. So let's say the NBA Finals matchup is set. Who's favored? How many, you know, who's the MVP favorite? So I'd write that and help out a guy, David Purdom, who does a wonderful job. He just needed some help. He can't write everything, right? And then once we started getting the feel, I started doing a column with picks and angles and telling old Vegas stories, like, you know, suitcases of cash or whatever it may be. So it was all sort of a evolution, if you will, of the website, the podcast, and also the TV hits, if you will, like the minute hits, minute and a half. And then gradually it was like, okay, we're actually going to launch a show now. And so it became, you know, just a snowball effect. But it was about my background, and the people who ran Chalk knew about it. So I just did double duty for about a year until I went solely into betting.
Yeah. So one thing I'm interested to find out about is what goes into anchoring a show. And obviously you talk about how you kind of analyze as well, but what's the daily prep like? Because everybody sees the window you're on TV, and some of the topics are already brought up daily, you know, about whatever's going on in sports. And some people just assume like it's a given that that's going to be brought up, but I'm sure there's a lot of planning that goes into each show and stuff. So how does that kind of go about? How do you guess get picked each week? Like, you know, who's going to be an analyst today compared to, you know, next week? So how does that all kind of come into a fold?
So for Daily Wager or Sports?
Yeah, for Daily Wager.
Yeah. So we have a schedule. Like, I'm hosting it every day, so that I know why I'm on air, and I kind of know. And then the other guys have set days. So like, Joe is off Tuesdays, Tyler's off Fridays, and Stanford, Steve, and the Bear picked their days as well. I don't know what I think. Steve's off Fridays. Bear does a hit. We're going to tape something from game day set. So that's predetermined. And then the content, the questions and the video, and is driven by like news of the day. So, you know, the Ravens having another running back that blows a knee, and then today they're signing Latavius Murray. Like, we're going to discuss that, especially with the beginning of the season. Like, do we trust the Ravens in general playing the futures game? What do we think? So taking stuff that's topical and then applying it through the lens of betting, I think it's a no-brainer. So you start there, and then obviously it's Friday. We're going to have picks for the weekend. And there's content. Now the question is, and we use this term a lot, is treatment. What's the treatment of the news of the day? You know, we know the news is already out. So how can a 6 o'clock, you know, several hours later, how can SportsCenter make it interesting to lead the show? So you can get a big number. You know, let's just make a number. 350 days total of injuries they have lost in the backfield. That is a record, or whatever it may be. It could be just some, you know, Tom Brady, you know, 300th career start, right? You know, whatever it may be. You can start there. Or you can start with a soundbite. You can start with – and so there's all sorts of ways to present it to the audience. In Europe, I believe, and definitely Australia – TV anchors are called presenters. So they're not anchors. So they present information. So what is the best way to present it? And I'm sure you two have discussions about this. What's the best way to present this topic? Because nowadays there's so much competition and everyone else has the news. Mm-hmm. What is the best way to like execute it? What's the treatment? What's the best presentation? So you want to make it memorable. So it's how you make, and it's very important that how you make someone feel is really important in this broadcasting world. Not necessarily what you say. It's now obviously those two are connected, but how you make someone feel is really kind of what moves the needle, so to speak, in all ratings worlds.
Yeah. And when you talk about the content and, you know, how you make someone feel, how it's going to be presented and everything. So one thing that I've been curious about, because I know a lot of kids our age, even younger, a lot of people get their information from social media now. They watch clips of Daily Wager on YouTube or on Twitter or things like that. So are there clips and things that you guys plan for, like topics where you're like, this is going to be good for social media content or good for a YouTube clip, and not really say we have this TV show and then just cut up whatever, you know what I mean?
Right. It's a little bit of both, but we now have people who are really knowledgeable about those things. So, for example, my high school best friend was in town last weekend visiting his brother, who lives in Vegas, and then I went and caught up with him at an event. They had their fantasy draft. It was like Saturday night or something. And some guy's like, oh, I just saw you on YouTube like 10 minutes ago. And I'm like, I don't even know our YouTube channel. But he's younger. He, you know, he watched, like, that's how people consume content. And that's not my area of expertise now. Should I be a blockhead idiot with blinders on? Of course not. But my job is to provide content and analysis of the betting market and let the producers say, hey, yeah, I need an IA, which that's a term we call individual analysis, on you're passionate about the coach of the year. You do 45 seconds for me, Belichick, why you like him, and just kind of go from there. And it's always on the heel of Mac Jones being announced the starter. So, like, say the Mac Jones, but, like, the real big money, you know, for his rookie of the year odds are this, but talk about why you think that's an angle for Belichick at 18-1. Mm-hmm. Or going into the weekend, like, what your best plays are. So there's pretty common sense things, and then there's just, you know, whatever the metrics show. And look, are we going to talk about LeBron every day? No. But does he move the needle? Yeah. So, like, if there's a LeBron comment or stuff, now that's more sort of First Take and some of that stuff. They know what resonates, and they have, you know, whether they have YouTube or social or whatever. I think there's really cool things that are done in all spaces. Like, we can all get along, right? But I think we have to be smart, whether it be on .com or digital or linear, or like Daily Wager is, creating content that appeals to your audience. So I do think the YouTube clip should be different than the one that was on TV, especially when we have video rights that vary. We kind of do have to retape it anyway. But yeah, I mean, you're appealing to an audience, and, you know, we are in the ratings business as much as that stinks. So if we just talked about Maction every day on Daily Wager, like, ratings would probably go down. We got to talk about the big games. So there's Iowa State this weekend. Like, I have to have an opinion. Now, I, as the host, don't have to have an opinion. Mm-hmm. And I can say why I don't have an opinion, present both sides. I'm like, it's tough. I'm going to probably approach it. So you have that option, but we still have to discuss the game. And the line moved from the look ahead line to the current one. So it's all part of the answer. I think if it was a week that was like packed with like more, you know, games, everything, then you have to pick and choose your spots. But yeah, you want to do like fun treatment of things for franchise pieces. And, you know, we have something called nightcap numbers. So, like, we play like smooth jazz music, like, hey, late at night on the fireplace, you know, the Hawaii game starts at 10 p.m. West Coast, you know, whatever, 1 a.m. Eastern. So there's ways to do it and have some fun with it as well, for sure.
So you bring up Iowa State.
Hold on. I wanted to go into that. Yeah. Go into that.
I had to ask, what are your picks? What are you thinking for Iowa State versus Iowa on Saturday?
So I know the look ahead line. I know I could have gotten 7 or 8 during the summer, but I would have to grab the 4, 4.5 right now. I just think, and Greg McElroy brought this up in the summer. He said, you know, obviously the defense is getting better for Iowa State, but that's just structured and built for the Big 12. It's not built for the trenches of Iowa. That's why the Hawkeyes have won 5 straight, right? Now, it's been a wonky series, a couple of those like muff punt in the rain. It's been some really close games, but I would have to grab the points. Now, I say that, not trying to kiss up, because also one of my favorite futures plays was Iowa under 8.5 wins. So I just thought the schedule is brutal, and it's about the math of it all. Now, I wouldn't take under 7.5, but I think 8-4 is a solid season. But maybe they go 9. If they go 9-3, you can't be afraid to lose a bet either. You got to play the percentages, so to speak. So it's going to be a grind of a season for sure. Obviously, this game will dictate a lot of that wager.
One of the lines, so we have a guy that contributes for our show, Levi. He has a blog, and he started it 2 weeks ago. He's had some pretty good picks. I think right now, lifetime, he's 6-1. So he's hot for this year so far. He picks his shots. He picks his spots. He said he really likes the under for this game. Do you have an opinion on that? Because I as well am hammering my fist on the table for that.
Yeah, I think it's tough. And I think the fun part of handicapping between week 1 and week 2 is kind of like assessing if you're right or not, right? You don't want to overreact to week 1, but at the same time, you got to stay fluid. And sometimes you're just way off your opinion of this team in the summer. And we've seen top 10 teams end the season unranked. We've seen ranked teams end the season unranked. So is there an overreaction to Iowa State struggling with an FCS school? Yeah, Hawkeyes look dominant, but I don't think Indiana's that great. I think last year was sort of fluky-ish. they're okay, Indiana, and they get the pick six. And so that game kind of got away from the Hoosiers, and they just folded Pennix's first game back. So both teams, we're going to see some regression, I would imagine. Iowa State to the positive. You would think Iowa to the negative. But who wins? I would lean under, but I think the world's on under, so you got to be careful there. There's a reason, the number's not lower, so to speak.
Right. No, it makes sense. And I think I read just this morning that it was, I don't know if this is right, but everybody and their sister is taking Iowa in the points.
Really? Well, that's probably your area.
Well, maybe, but the thought being, a lot of people just with this 5-game win streak, they don't see, their emotions don't see how Iowa State can win this game.
Yeah, for
sure. And that's where they get caught into this. I don't see any value in this Iowa State bet, so I'm just going to go take the points or the money line value on Iowa. And you sitting here telling me everyone is and their sister's taking the under has me overthinking it now a little too. So now I got to go do my own little research because you're doing your job perfectly. You're analyzing this to me. I need to go do my own analysis right now. Now, let me turn this on to you. Is there any matchup that you kind of have circled on this college football schedule, just the entire season? Is there one that you've looked at and you're just like, man, I can't wait to see how this just the line unfolds or just how people react to this one? Or you kind of just take it as
funny,
it comes?
When the futures market, the look-ahead lines, we call them, came out, and Bama was laying, I think, 11.5 against A&M in College Station, everyone's like, oh, that game will close single digits. Yeah, like Jimbo at home. It's like, really? Alabama looked pretty good. I think there's a lot of people. So the reloading of Bama. Last few years, we knew the receivers were there. This was a full reload with an offense coordinator after Sark left, bringing Bill O'Brien. Bryce Young, obviously, stud quarterback in SoCal, but still – he was a giant unknown, and a lot of these receivers are unknowns as well. We just got a taste of it against Miami, so I'm curious to see how that A&M, just the point spread, where it closes, because I told everyone there's no guarantee it closes a single digit, so don't just grab 11.5 blindly.
Speaking of college sports, one thing I want to ask you about, which I kind of referenced earlier, is you got to do the radio for College Game Day for a couple of years. What was that experience like? What were some of your favorite moments working College Game Day? And if you had to pick a couple schools that were the best schools for College Game Day, what would they be?
Well, it's very different than the TV show. So sometimes we were on late at night and they're over at a certain time, but sometimes we were at the same venue, sometimes we were not. But it was an awesome experience because of many things. Anytime you're doing something that feels big, it's cool. So it was the first time I was doing something that was real front lines for ESPN. And getting to travel. We didn't travel every weekend, but getting to travel to some of those venues, and you're calling games 7 hours. Now, you're not doing play-by-play, but you have two guests. You're on for 7 hours with radio breaks, and you are traffic copping and communicating to the viewer as games are ending, discussing storylines, and putting a bow on stuff. What's the domino effect of this upset? And it was just an unreal experience, and I loved the team I was with. Trevor Maddich and Brad Edwards, great dudes. And we had a nice chemistry. Got to do it for 3 years. I mean, my favorite venues, I got to go to UCLA. So being from LA, like, I got my mom on the set. She just sat there in the corner and got to hang out for 5 hours. And my brother came with one of his newborns. High school friends were there who had gone to UCLA. I think it was an alumni weekend for volleyball teams. And it was in that Friday night, I got dinner with my best friend who was going to propose to his girlfriend the next day. When they were going to go to like Malibu or something. So that whole weekend was kind of surreal, coming back home, doing all that. So that was special to me. Now, the crowd wasn't crazy or anything like that. We've had some awesome crowds, for sure. Alabama at night was awesome. I mean, just the fact that the stadium's next to a bunch of Kearney Road, I mean, it's just insane. Getting to experience nothing like Death Valley, but I did not go to a night game, but being there for that game. Now, I went as a fan to a night game, but just getting to experience Southeast, having grown up in LA and some of the SEC games, but Penn State was a nice crowd as well. And I'll tell you what, where the stage is set is a big part too. At Washington, we were set up, and the way the kickoff was right near the main gate. So right outside, it was Washington and Oregon, I believe it was. No, Washington, USC. And it was packed. I mean, wall to wall people. Really cool opportunity just to have that. You know, work with the crowd and heckle them and like playful. And it was 7 hours, a very warm games are going on. People are throwing football in the parking lot, very casual. So we were part of the tailgate, if you will, rather than like that morning craziness leading up to the kickoff. It was while games are going on. And it was, I mean, it's really cool. College football, as you guys know, is such a big part of our country and the outcomes of the games on Saturday. So again, to be on the front lines of that was awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. And one other thing I want to ask you about in terms of your career, you guest hosted different shows and stuff too. What's that like to step in for different people? Like, you know, if it's not a set or a show, you're working with daily, like I'm sure with Daily Wager, you know, everybody on the set, you have your team right. of people. What's it like, you know, at least like for Mike and Mike, for example, what's it like to step in for Golic or Green, like, and to have that on air chemistry and like, how do you get comfortable like guest hosting?
You don't, I mean, you're there not to F it up. Right. I mean, I remember I did First Take when I first started, like the first year.
Wow.
And that's a different role. I mean, that's not Mike and Mike filling in, right? Yeah. And so the guy was like, just stay out of the way. Like, you're not there. You know, you're going to be forgettable. You know, it was like, just you're a replacement for the host, and Stephen A. and Skip. And I had to just ask some questions. I paid attention. And I'll never forget, Stephen A. during the commercial looks at me, he's like, good job. Because there was one time where it was like, he was trying to remember something that happened in the Giants game, and I paid attention for like 2 straight hours and didn't say a damn word besides the commercials and all that. And he was looking, and he's like, I think it was like fourth down. And so I just like gave him a little spot. So that job took spotting, so to speak, more than anything, and just knowing your role. People can, you know, I remember I was calling SportsCenter and I was trying to jam all these information into a highlight. He's like, dude, it's a 2-play highlight. Do the highlight that's asked of you, not the 6-play highlight and the 2-play highlight. Do the 2-play. Pick what you want to say in that 2-play, put your own stamp on it, but it's a 2-play highlight, not a 6-play. So that job necessitated I do X, Y, and Z. When I filled in on radio, a little bit more, I mean, yes, they have segments that are sponsored or whatever, but outside of that, you're yourself, you communicate over via email with the producers, what you're hot on, obviously the news of the day, the stop topics drive it. And, you know, when you're filling in on some other shows, whether it be Baseball Tonight, I mean, you're there to move the sticks. Now, if it's a one-time starter, like, hey, you're the fill-in all season, you might be doing 15 shows, then you can sort of flex your muscles a little bit, stretch it a little bit, be like, hey, what about this? Maybe not the first meeting, but like the fourth meeting. Hey, have we thought about doing this? Because ESPN, like the producers are amazing here. And one thing that's always important, it's about getting it right, not who's right. So, I mean, obviously you want to be deferential to a producer. You want to be, you know, respectful. But bringing up a good idea is a good thing. And even if it doesn't work, they want you to be collaborative and not – they want you to be invested. Like, anytime the on-air people are invested in a show, it's better for the show.
So one of our last questions, and we can't thank you enough for taking the time – you have had the opportunity to interview a lot of people throughout your career. What was the most rewarding moment or most rewarding interview that you personally had?
On a personal level, so I got to go to Guantanamo Bay when I was in Iowa. This was on the, you know, Iraq War time, and to go out there, I mean, literally you're flying to, I think, San Juan, and then we took a smaller plane to Guantanamo and just being on the base and going that, seeing the orange, the prisoners in orange jumpsuits and doing interviews with local troops who had been out there for so long and doing all the amazing stuff they do for our country. I mean, that stays with you forever. And a really cool opportunity. I was very young at the time, and I'm sure I would have asked certain questions then than I do now. But it was just awesome to just experience that, the authentic kind of behind the scenes look that I would never otherwise get to experience. From a sports fan standpoint, I mean, it was pretty cool getting to interview Magic. Now, it's not when he's up on a stage, but I got to do a one-on-one with a guy I grew up. He was my guy. Yeah. And, you know, when you see them just – now, I took, like, a selfie with Shaq, or, like, that was cool, too. And it wasn't like – they shouldn't even do that, let alone talk to me. So the fact that Magic's talking to me – I did a sit-down with Kobe. He had a camp in Vegas, and I think the PR person, like, kind of botched it. So I was the only one who showed up. I didn't know about it. They called me that morning. I just happened to have my cell phone on my workstation voicemail. And so I get there at like 9:30, make some calls and get the camera guy. And we were setting up and Kobe was ready. And I think the camera would malfunction. So the guy had to like move some stuff, some lighting. And so Kobe asked me like, what's it like living in Las Vegas? And like, I started giving the generic response, like when my mom asked me or whatever, it was just like rehearsed. And he started like completing he was like very engaged in the interview just before the cameras were rolling. he sort of completed my sentence. Oh, so, you know, I'm like, yeah, and he, well, listen, but just stuff like that. Again, when I'm younger, now that I'm older, like, you know, you're kind of desensitized to it all. And you really just care who they are as a person. There's a bunch of guys like my cube was next to Herm Edwards' cube when he was there. And we chatted a bunch and I asked him. I mean, I asked Barry Melrose, like, why can't a sumo wrestler play goalie? Like, I asked these guys, like,
what did he say? And I'm curious what that answer
is. It just wouldn't work. They're not big enough. It's not what you think. You still need agility. I mean, imagine going out and chasing the puck when they wrap it around the boards, you know, all that stuff too.
That ain't happening.
Yeah. But like, they're all very tolerant of ridiculous stuff. Tim Hasselbeck, I ask him a million questions all the time when I corner him. And Ryan Clark's great. All these guys, it's not for everyone, but once they're there, they kind of, it's awesome. So, I'm appreciative of Chris Berman. I went to Brown. I met him when I was an undergrad. I introduced him when he won some alumni award, found him 15 years later, like all that kind of stuff. And the fact that I've had him on the pod and I, you know, stuff like that is really cool. So that stuff's more on a personal level and just having friends. And I think like the novelty is worn off, but like the fact that like Kenny Mayne and I can text back and forth about gambling stuff or whatever. And he's an awesome guy. And he went to my going away party and Steve Levy and all these like wonderful people. Yeah. I mean, when I first got there and like Stuart Scott introduced himself to me and Van Pelt did the same. And his next line was stop winning the pool. Cause like I was in the college football pool. I had just started. So people knew I was before they even met me. I'd won like the first 2 weeks or something. And so playful stuff like that. You remember those moments. So it's really cool. And then like you guys said, like doing these shows, co-hosting SportsCenter and just doing all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's, the younger version of me would never believe all this stuff, and hopefully there's a lot more memories to come.
Well, I guarantee there are a lot more memories to come, and we cannot thank you enough for taking the time today to talk with us. Just like we started, guys, check out our socials, Twitter, Instagram. We're on Spotify, Apple, all of that good stuff, and YouTube. Like always, not the same time, same place. We will see you guys later.